Okay, and we will go to 2 Kings, chapter 24 is where we are today. We'll go back a little bit and read in chapter 23, the last little bit of that chapter. And we will look at four different kings this morning. So let's begin with prayer. Father, I do ask for your guidance as we open up your word. I pray that you would lead us and help us to think right and to speak right and to hear right. And I do pray that you would help us understand the things that are written here. Amen. Why don't we begin reading with chapter 23 of 2 Kings, verse 31. And Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Jemutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. And Pharaoh Necho put him in bands at Riblah in the land of Hamath, that he might not reign in Jerusalem, and put the land to a tribute of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. And Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, the son of Josiah, king in the room of Josiah his father, and turned his name to Jehoiakim, and took Jehoahaz away, and he came to Egypt and died there. And Jehoiakim gave the silver and the gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land to give the money according to the commandment of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and the gold of the people of the land, of every one according to his taxation, to give it unto Pharaoh Necho. Jehoiakim was 25 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Zebudah, the daughter of Pedaiah of Rumah. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. In his days Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant 3 years. Then he turned and rebelled against him. And the Lord sent against him the bands of the Chaldees, and bands of the Syrians, and bands of the Moabites, and bands of the children of Ammon, and sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Lord, which he spake by his servants the prophets. Surely at the commandment of the Lord came this upon Judah, to remove them out of his sight for the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he did, and also for the innocent blood that he shed, for he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiachin, his son, reigned in his stead. And the king of Egypt came not again any more out of his land, for the king of Babylon had taken from the river of Egypt unto the river Euphrates all that pertained to the king of Egypt. Jehoiachin was 18 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned in Jerusalem 3 months. And his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnathan of Jerusalem. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father had done. At that time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up against Jerusalem, and the city was besieged. And Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came against the city, and his servants did besiege it. And Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and his princes and his officers, and the king of Babylon took him in the 8th year of his reign. And he carried out thence all the treasure of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, as the Lord had said. And he carried away all Jerusalem, and all the princes, and all the mighty men of valor, even 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and smiths, none remained, save the poorest sort of the people of the land. And he carried away Jehoiachin to Babylon, and the king's mother, and the king's wives, and his officers, and the mighty of the land, those he carried into captivity from Jerusalem to Babylon. And all the men of might, even 7,000, and craftsmen and smiths 1,000, all that were strong and apt for war, even them the king of Babylon brought captive to Babylon. And the king of Babylon made Mattaniah, his father's brother, king in his stead, and changed his name to Zedekiah, Zedekiah was 21 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. And his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For through the anger of the Lord it came to pass in Jerusalem and Judah, until he had cast them out of his presence, that Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. All right. There is but one more chapter in the book of 2 Kings. And Zedekiah, who we just read about, is the last king that will reign in Judah. He was set up over the kingdom as by Nebuchadnezzar, who had conquered the land and had carried Jehoiakim away. He set Zedekiah up in his place, and Zedekiah was supposed to be obedient to the king of Babylon. He didn't. He didn't listen to him. He rebelled against him. And Jeremiah and Zedekiah had a lot of conversation about this over the course of Zedekiah's 11-year reign, when Jeremiah told him that from God that he was to submit to the king. He refused to do it. Eventually, King Nebuchadnezzar ends up coming back and taking Jerusalem again, taking the king who he had set up and carrying him away. And at that point, they broke the city apart, and nobody was there again for, I think it was 70 years. I'm not sure if it was 70 years from that time or if it was 70 years from the time that Jehoiakim was carried away. I didn't actually look that up, but they were in captivity for 70 years. And whence Ezra is sent back to Jerusalem from Cyrus, a new king in that land. Ezra is sent back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And then eventually Nehemiah is sent back to Jerusalem to rebuild the city. So this is the end of the story of the kings. Zedekiah is the last king. And there has not been a king in Israel of the sons of David from this day, from when Zedekiah was taken off the throne and carried to Babylon in the next chapter. There's not been a king in Jerusalem of the sons of David from that day until this. But Jesus Christ, who was born in the line of the kings of the sons of David, of the seed of David, as God promised, has been made a king forever and will one day return, probably sooner than we are expecting. He will one day return, and he's coming to Jerusalem, and he is going to reign there. And of his kingdom there will be no end. He is the fulfillment of all the prophecies that were made to Abraham, to Adam, to David, to Solomon, and so on. And if you go to look at all the different people in the Old Testament that God promised that a king would come that he would send of their seed and of them, whatever. There's many, many different promises to many different people. Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of every single one of those prophecies that God gave, or promises that God gave to the people of the Old Testament. He is in heaven right now, seated at God's right hand. But he is coming back, and he will continue where Zedekiah left off. Only Zedekiah was a sinner, and Jesus will bring righteousness to the entire earth. Anybody who will not have righteousness will not be allowed to live. So in this last few verses of chapter 23 through this chapter 24, we read about four kings. If you guys probably can't remember their names anymore. And in fact, throughout the scripture, many people have multiple names throughout the scripture. And so I'll just give you this list right here. Jehoahaz is the first one. When Josiah dies, Jehoahaz is made king. Josiah calls him by the name of Shalom. when he writes about him in the book of, Jeremiah in chapter 22. We'll go there in a little bit and we'll read Jeremiah chapter 22. So Jeremiah calls him Shalom. He is the first one that takes over the kingdom after when Josiah dies. Pharaoh comes and gets him, carries him into Egypt, and Pharaoh sets up another one of Josiah's sons, whose name had been Eliakim, but he changes his name to Jehoiakim. He reigns for 11 years there in Jerusalem. Jehoiakim dies, and his son Jehoiachin, or he's also called Jeconiah or Coniah in the scriptures. So by three names, Jehoiakim, Coniah, or Jeconiah, he is not put on the throne. When Jehoiakim dies, he comes to the throne, but is only there for 3 months. He, the son of Jehoiakim, then Nebuchadnezzar comes, takes him, carries him away to Babylon, and puts Zedekiah, who is another one of Josiah's sons, back on the throne. So actually three of Josiah's sons reign in Jerusalem. Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Zedekiah all reign on the throne in Jerusalem. This is all in the course of Jehoahaz only reigns for 3 months. Jehoiakim reigns for 11 years. Jehoiachin reigns for 3 months. And Zedekiah reigns for 11 years. So this is in the space of about 22 to 23 years that all four of these kings are on the throne in Jerusalem. Now, it is almost depressing to think about the fact that Josiah has brought the nation a great revival. He destroyed all the idol worship out of the nation. And he has three wicked sons who reign on the throne of Israel. Where did these sons come from? What did Josiah not do that he should have done? In the fact that he has these wicked sons who reign in Jerusalem. Zedekiah, you can go to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah talks to Zedekiah all the time. In the days of Zedekiah, the things that were happening in Israel were every bit as bad as what Josiah had destroyed out of the land just a few years earlier. There is no way to fully appreciate or understand the wickedness of human beings. But I'll tell you that this is the truth. And if anybody in this room has one shred of pride, you should read the Bible. It'll humble you. You may think that you have the ability to serve God and to raise good kids and that your children will serve God. And the fact of the matter is, you have the ability, every single person that's sitting in this room, you have the ability to be just proud enough to completely destroy your life in spite of the grace of God. That is the truth. I don't know how many Christian people have had children who have absolutely forsaken God entirely, entirely forsaken God. And many times those Christian people would have told you if you had asked them that they were raising their children according to the scriptures and that the Bible said that if you train up a child in the way he should go when he's old, he won't depart from it. And they would have given you the confidence that their family was going to serve God. Now, I'm not against confidence. I think that we see this in godly people too, like Joshua, for example, when he says, "As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." I'm not telling you not to make that statement. Don't you can say me and my house are going to serve the Lord, but you better be humble about it, because you and your house have bad hearts, and you and your house can turn away from God at the snap of a finger if you don't listen to what he says. So all these sons of Jeremiah reigning in Jerusalem, wicked kings, these sons of Josiah. Did I say Jeremiah? Now I can't even hear myself. But I think I'm mixing these two names up here. But I want to turn to Jeremiah chapter 22 now, and I want to read a chapter where Jeremiah was sent to the house of David, to the kingdom. He was sent with a message from God to these men. And I want to read what he says in chapter 22 of Jeremiah. Thus saith the Lord, go down to the house of the king of Judah and speak there this word. And say, hear the word of the Lord, O king of Judah, that sittest upon the throne of David, thou and thy servants and thy people that enter in by thy gates. Thus saith the Lord, execute ye judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor, and do no wrong. Do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow, neither shed innocent blood in this place. For if ye do this thing indeed, then there shall enter in by the gates of the house of this house kings sitting upon the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, he and his servants and his people. But if ye will not hear these words, I swear by myself, saith the Lord, that this house shall become a desolation. For thus saith the Lord unto the king's house of Judah, thou art Gilead unto me, and the head of Lebanon. Yet surely I will make thee a wilderness, and cities which are not inhabited. And I will prepare destroyers against thee, every one with his weapons. And they shall cut down thy choice cedars, and cast them into the fire. And many nations shall pass by this city, and they shall say every man to his neighbor, wherefore hath the Lord done thus unto the great city? And they shall answer, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord their God, and worshipped other gods, and served them. Weep ye not for the dead, neither bemoan him, but weep sore for him that goeth away, for he shall return no more, nor see his native country. For thus saith the Lord, touching Shalom, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, which reigned instead of Josiah his father, which went out of this place, he shall not return thither any more. This is that Shalom who I said Josiah called. This is Jehoahaz, the one who reigned 3 months. He was the one who came to the throne immediately after his father. He was carried into Egypt, and he never returned. He shall not return thither anymore, Jeremiah says. But he shall die in the place whither they have led him captive, and shall see his land no more. Woe unto him that buildeth his house by unrighteousness, and his chambers by wrong, that useth his neighbor's service without wages, and giveth him not for his work. Thus saith, I will build me a wide house and large chambers, and cutteth him out windows, and it is sealed with cedar and painted with vermilion. Shalt thou reign because thou closest thyself in cedar? Did not thy father eat and drink and do judgment and justice, and then it was well with him? He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well with him. Was not this to know me, saith the Lord? But thine eyes and thine heart are not but for thy covetousness, and for to shed innocent blood, and for oppression, and for violence to do it. Therefore thus saith the Lord concerning Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah. They shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, my brother, or Ah, sister. They shall not lament for him, saying, Ah, Lord, or Ah, his glory. He shall be buried with the burial of an ass, drawn and cast forth beyond the gates of Jerusalem. Go up to Lebanon and cry, and lift up thy voice in Bashan, and cry from the passages, for all thy lovers are destroyed. I spake unto thee in thy prosperity, but thou saidst, I will not hear. This hath been thy manner from thy youth, that thou obeyest not my voice. The wind shall eat up all thy pastors, and thy lovers shall go into captivity. Surely then shalt thou be ashamed and confounded for all thy wickedness. O inhabitant of Lebanon, that makest thy nest in the cedars, how gracious shalt thou be when pangs come upon thee, the pain as of a woman in travail. As I live, saith the Lord, though Coniah the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were the signet upon my right hand, yet would I pluck thee thence. And I will give thee into the hand of them that seek thy life, and into the hand of them whose face thou fearest, even into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. And I will cast thee out, and thy mother that bare thee, into another country, where ye were not born, and there ye shall die. But to the land whereunto they desire to return, thither shall they not return. Is this man Coniah a despised broken idol? Is he a vessel wherein is no pleasure? Wherefore are they cast out, he and his seed, and are cast into a land which they know not? O earth, earth, hear the word of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord, write ye this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days. For no man of his seed shall prosper, sitting upon the throne of David and ruling any more in Judah. Now Jeremiah is sent by God to go speak in the king's house the words that we read in this chapter. And he speaks very specifically of three men in this chapter. He does not speak of Zedekiah at all in this chapter. There's lots in the book of Jeremiah about Zedekiah, but this chapter was not about Zedekiah. It was about Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, and Jehoiachin, called respectively Shalom and Jehoiakim and Coniah. Jeremiah mentions the fact that Shalom, or Jehoahaz, has been carried into Egypt and he's not coming back. He mentions the fact that Jehoiakim is going to have a rough death, where they're going to literally drag him out of the city and leave him outside the city walls. They're not going to have a proper burial for him, and nobody is going to say anything good about him. Now, there's another statement in the book of Jeremiah. I didn't write this down, but I believe he says that he's going to be tossed on the open field, basically. He says he's going to be under the frost, and I forget how it says it, but basically this Jehoiakim was never buried. He was taken out and left in a field outside the city. And his son, Jehoiakim, or Coniah, who isn't even on the throne as Jeremiah is speaking these words, he's not even on the throne yet, he says about this man that he, with his mother and all of his friends and everybody, are going to be carried into Babylon. Now, this is long before this happened. This is God's prophetic voice coming to the kingdom that this man, Coniah, will be carried away into another country. And he says, write this man childless, a man that shall not prosper in his days, for no man of his seed shall prosper, sitting upon the throne of David and ruling in Judah, and ruling any more in Judah. The kingdom was over at this point. This man, Coniah, or Jeconiah, we will find in the genealogies in the New Testament, in the line of Christ. We can discern this by reading other portions of Scripture about this man, that when Josiah says, write ye this man childless, he didn't actually, the meaning of that was not the fact that he would have no children, but the fact that he would never have another king on the throne, okay? Because we find from other passages in Scripture, I believe it's in the Chronicles and maybe elsewhere, that this Jeconiah did have sons, and his son will be mentioned in the book of Matthew as you're reading the genealogy of Christ. So Jeconiah, or Coniah, or Jehoiachin, the last in succession in the kingdom of Israel, God promises to him through Jeremiah that this man will never have a son forever that will ever reign again in Jerusalem. Now, when we come to the New Testament, we find that though Jesus inherits the throne through Joseph, who is in this line of the kings, he is not Joseph's son. He is rather the son of Mary by the Holy Spirit of God. And he is also of the seed of David, who the seed of David, God promised that the king that he would send, this Messiah that he would send, would be of David's seed. Mary also was of David's seed. And Mary's genealogy is traced in the book of Luke all the way back to Adam. David is in the line. So Jesus is born of the seed of David. He is born in the line of the kings, but he is not the son of Joseph, except as that Joseph was his father by marriage. So when God gave this promise or threat or whatever you will say, this prophecy about Coniah, that no man of his seed will ever prosper again reigning in Judah, there was never another king from that day of David's line until this day. It was the end of David's kingdom. And Jesus, when he comes forth, is not the son of this Coniah. You'll notice if you go back and you study all the promises that God made to each specific person, he promises David that this Messiah that's going to come will be of his seed. He never promised Solomon that. He promised David that. He promised Solomon that his throne would endure forever, but he never promised that it would be of his seed. Jesus is not of the seed of Solomon, because Mary traces her genealogy back through David, and it is not through the line of the kings. So the promises that were made to David that Jesus would be born of David's seed, those promises come through Mary. The promises that were made to Solomon that Jesus would the throne of Solomon would be established forever, Jesus inherits Solomon's throne, as well as all the other kings that sat after Solomon in David's line. But Jesus is not the son of the kings, because God, through the wickedness of the kings, quit. And he, of course, he knew this all the way back from before the beginning of the world. He knew exactly everything that was going to happen. And so when he said to this man, Coniah, he said, "You're not going to ever have another, you're never going to have a son in your line that's going to prosper ever again sitting on this throne in Jerusalem." He knew exactly what he was doing. And he kept every promise that he ever made to anybody about the Messiah that he was bringing. And he kept his promise to this man, Coniah, too, where Jesus being the king that will reign in David's line forever is not come from this line of the kings. So I want to look at a few of the things that Jeremiah says in this chapter 22, because I think they're important. We don't get much information when we are reading back in the book of the Kings. When we read the chapter 24 that mentioned these guys, we don't get much of any detail about their lives or what they did or how they lived or anything. But we get some detail as we come to the book of Jeremiah when God is speaking to them. Very clearly, he calls them out for certain things. And I want you guys to listen carefully to this book, this 22nd chapter of Jeremiah, because it is the essence of what we believe to be godliness. When you come into the New Testament and you go to the book of James, you'll find out that God says that we're supposed to visit the fatherless and the widow in their affliction and keep ourselves unspotted from the world. That's the duty of us as Christians, to take care of people who need help and to separate from the world, okay? And in real true simplicity, in real true Christianity is just that simple. We do not have a maze of things to meander in Christianity trying to figure out the differences between right and wrong. The fact of the matter is we forsake the world in its entirety, and the purpose that we have to live on this earth is to take care of God's people. and that is God's people, whether they're saved or lost. I mean, that is our job, to take care of the whole world. And so listen to what God says in this chapter. I'm just going to pull out a few verses. In verse 3 of chapter 22 of Jeremiah, he says, "Thus saith the Lord, execute ye judgment and righteousness, and deliver the spoiled out of the hand of the oppressor, and do no wrong, do no violence to the stranger, the fatherless, nor the widow, neither shed innocent blood in this place. For if ye do this thing indeed, then there shall enter in by the gates of the house kings sitting upon the throne of David, riding in chariots and on horses, he and his servants and his people. But if you'll not do these words, I swear by myself, saith the Lord, that this house shall become a desolation." God is crying to the kings of David right now, the sons of David, who are sitting on the throne in Israel, and he's telling them to do basic things, like not kill innocent people, to take care of strangers that are in the land, to look after the fatherless and the widow, and to execute judgment. These things are so simple. They're so simple. Why is it so difficult for a king who has risen all the way to the top in the world, who sits in the top place, why is it so difficult for him to understand the basic difference between right and wrong? Well, we sit there in America right now, today. We do, and I want to show you a verse in this chapter that changed my life years ago. And I'll give you a little story connected with it. Let's just start reading at verse 11 for the context. "For thus saith the Lord, touching Shalom, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, which reigned instead of Josiah his father, which went forth out of this place, he shall not return thither any more, but he shall die in the place whither they have led him captive, and shall see this land no more. Woe unto him that buildeth his house by unrighteousness, and his chambers by wrong, that useth his neighbor's service without wages, and giveth him not for his work. Thus saith, I will build me a wide house and large chambers, and cutteth him out windows, and it is sealed with cedar and painted with vermilion. Shalt thou reign because thou closest thyself in cedar? Did not thy father eat and drink, and do judgment and justice, and then it was well with him? He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well with him. Was not this to know me, saith the Lord? But thine eyes and thine heart are not but for thy covetousness, and to shed innocent blood, and for oppression, and for violence to do it." Years ago, I decided I wanted to have an unhappy life, so I decided to start a business. That's what happens. If you want to be unhappy, start a business. If you want to be unhappier, work for somebody else. It's unhappiness no matter what you do. It's all unhappiness. Anybody can find unhappiness wherever they look for it. But I decided I wanted to start a business, and I wasn't prepared for it. I wasn't ready. I didn't have much money. I had been a poor person all my life, and we ended up, because I'm not patient at all, we ended up deciding, me and my friend who we started with were considering building a building to open a bulk food store in, and we ended up deciding that that probably wasn't the best way to do things, because it was going to take us a few years to work to save up enough money to build the building that we wanted. So we said, why build a building? Let's just go rent. Then we can do it right away. Well, we took all the money that we had, both her and me, took all the money that we had and invested it in the business and opened Golden Harvest. Well, then okay, now we have a business to run. We have bills to pay. and there is no money. So either the money comes in from sales at the business, or otherwise there, you know, you don't make it. So we struggled for some years trying to get Golden Harvest running, and it just so happened that I have 6 brothers and sisters, and Alicia had 9 brothers and sisters. And the bulk of our brothers and sisters did not work when we opened the store. So it was kind of the in thing to do sometimes to come by and hang out at the store. And they came and helped, and they did this and they did that. And for a few years, actually, it was that way, that there was a lot of people hanging out at the store all the time who did not have a job, didn't have much of anything to do, and they just came by to hang out, and we put them to work. And one day, I was just happening to be in my Bible, and I read this verse, and it really bothered me. I read this verse. "Woe unto him that buildeth his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by wrong, that useth his neighbor's service without wages, and giveth him not for his work." And I'm gonna tell you, this is a complex situation that I'm talking about right now, and I do not believe for a moment that it is wrong to have somebody do something for you and not get paid. Okay, that's what we do as friends and as family, and there's nothing wrong with somebody coming over to my house. Did you hear me say that? There's nothing wrong with you guys coming over to my house and volunteering to help me, okay? There's nothing wrong with that. You should all be there at least once a week. It's a good thing to do. It's a good thing for a sister to help her sister who had a baby. And I would say it would be nearly a shameful thing for a sister who was helping her sister who just had a baby to ask for money for it. That would be almost ridiculous. But I realized that at this point, when I read these words, that it had been some years since I had opened Golden Harvest, and my sisters, and at that point it was Nikki that was with me in the store, and her sisters were working for us all the time, constantly there all the time, helping out and doing this and that. And I felt like it was the right thing. I thought that's what they were supposed to do. I felt like maybe more or less, you know, I have this big project going. Why shouldn't they be here helping me? Obviously, I couldn't pay them because I wasn't paying myself. I was barely living at the time with near zero money, which is kind of the way it's always been for 20-some years. But if I wasn't even paying myself enough to take care of myself, I certainly couldn't have paid for all the help that they were giving. But I started feeling guilty about the fact that it wasn't the fact that it was wrong that our families volunteered to help us. What was wrong was the fact that I looked at the situation as that it was a good thing. Like, it was something that I should be getting. It was something that I would have been very willing potentially to have taken advantage of. And you listen to what Jeremiah says. "Woe unto him that buildeth his house by unrighteousness and his chambers by wrong, that useth his neighbor's service without wages and giveth him not for his work." God says that in the New Testament it is written of God, God is not unrighteous to forget your labor. In other words, God, the same words that were spoken to the king of Israel at this moment, God says about us, his people, that if he did not reward us for the work that we do for him, he would be unrighteous. He calls it unrighteousness if he didn't pay us for serving him. What does God owe us when we owe him everything because he purchased us with his blood? What does God owe us? He just shouldn't owe us anything. But the fact is, he says about himself that he wouldn't be unrighteous to forget our labor. but that he's going to reward us for our labor for him, because it would be unrighteous if he didn't. Now, that's coming from God's standpoint. He can say that about himself. We couldn't say that to God, but he can say that about himself. The next verse here, he says, that saith, I will build me a wide house and a large chamber, and cutteth him out windows, and is sealed with cedar, and painted with vermilion, and so on. Now, let's just say, for example, that Dale says, you know, I've been a poor man all my life, and I visited Los Angeles, and I liked the way they lived out there. And I feel like this house here that I have isn't good enough for me. And I am going to build myself a 10,000 square foot home in Rhinelander here that's going to cost me $1.2 million, okay? So Dale says, I'm going to do this. Well, he gets started, and it's actually funner to sit on the couch and drink coffee than to build. And so he doesn't, this is a lot of work. And he says, you know, hey, well, I've got a lot of sons and daughters and sons-in-laws and daughters-in-laws, and I got a lot of friends in church, and this project is bigger than I can do. So doesn't it make sense that my sons and my daughters and sons-in-laws and daughters-in-laws and friends at church and stuff like that should come over and help me because this project is too big for me? Would that make sense? Well, the fact of the matter is, what is it about our covetousness that wants things that are bigger than we can produce, gives us therefore the right to have what we want just because we decided to get it? And this is what happens in life. And of course, we have a lot of people react to the rich. And they want to bring socialism in its place because we see the rich abusing people. Well, I agree that the rich people do abuse people a lot, and that they get rich many times by means that are very unfair. Of course, we know that socialism is not the answer to that, and it would actually cause more trouble than it would help. It's a stupid human answer to a covetous problem. But the fact is, I need you to think about this for a moment. Let's say that I should have a chain of stores across the country with 100 stores. I know my goal is 1,000, but let's just say I should have a chain of stores across the country that has 100 stores in it. Let's say that I should have that, and because this is a little bit too big for me to reach, it would be good if all my friends and neighbors and so on chipped in and helped me out a little bit. Well, okay, so at the end of my life, when I get to be 92 years old and I finally have reached my goal, then what are all my friends and neighbors and family, who helped them reach their goal? If they're helping me reach my goal, who helped them reach theirs? Why should I be the owner of this business and not them? That's covetousness. Now, I do not believe that it would be wrong for me to own 100 stores. I'll probably never do it, but I don't believe it would be wrong to own 100 stores. But if I get in my mind that I should be able to own 100 stores while somebody else is giving to me of themselves so that I can build my life, then I am directly in the teeth of what God is saying to the kings of Judah right here. It's my covetous that wants something for me, and I think that somebody else should be responsible for helping me get what I need. God never promised us. He told us that he would give us our food. He told us he would give us shelter. He promised he would give us joy. He offered us things like a wife or a husband. He offered us children. He never told us that we could be elevated in some way above our brothers, or that we should, at somebody else's expense, become rich. I think the Mennonites use principles like this a little bit when they actually have in their church handbooks, I'm not even sure what it exactly says, but basically it limits them to a specific size of business. They can't have more than a certain number of employees or a certain dollar amount of sales. I'm not sure exactly where it is, but I know one Mennonite who was running a bulk food store in central Wisconsin area, and then he started a distribution center, and the church ended up making him sell the distribution center because his business got to be too big. And so he could not, now he didn't, he wasn't abusing anybody, he wasn't doing anything wrong, but it was just in the church policy, his business got to be too big for him to own it as a Mennonite. And so he kept his store and sold the distribution center to somebody else. I don't think that's biblical at all, but I think that they're basing that on things like this, where our covetousness can lead us to want things that are bigger than what we were made for. I have no idea. I have been running Golden Harvest for long enough to know better than wanting 100 stores, but I still do. Can't tell you why I do. I have no idea why I do. I just do. But the fact of the matter is, at this point now, if I can't legitimately own those 100 stores, all the while that I am taking care of every poor person that I find, and that I'm helping every needy person that I find, and I am the one who is responsible for the widows, and I am the one who is taking care of the person who needs help, and I am paying everybody legitimate wages who is working for me, at least legitimate in my own opinion. I mean, you don't have to work for me if you don't want to, okay? This is a free country, and if I offer you a certain wage and you don't like it, you go to my neighbor who will offer you less, okay? But if I can get 100 stores by legitimate work, where God is first in my life and people are second, that is the biblical pattern, God first, people second. If I can do that, and I am not reaching for something for myself, thinking that people owe me something, then there's nothing wrong with me owning 100 stores. But it must be in keeping with what God calls judgment. He says to this man, Jehoiakim, whose father was Josiah, he says, do judgment and justice. Let's back up here. Did not thy father eat and drink and do judgment and justice, and then it was well with him? He judged the cause of the poor and needy. Then it was well with him. Was not this to know me, saith the Lord? God says to Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, doing justice and judgment, judging the cause of the poor and the needy, this was synonymous with knowing God. And this is, he said, this is what Josiah did. This is why I took care of Josiah and why I was for him. But this is what you haven't done. You can go to the book of Job. We're not going to turn there this morning, but you can go to the book of Job and find out that this is what Job was known for. Job was known for taking care of people. It was what his righteousness consisted of. There was nobody around him who was hurting or that was needy that he didn't personally help or share with. And Job became the richest man of all the men of the East. The scripture says he became very wealthy while he was taking care of people. I know we're running past time already. I don't know if I ever actually fully told this story in church, but I'll just mention it one more time, that we were looking for about 4 years to build the store in Merrill from the time we had bought the little place, and we were trying to expand it, and we just couldn't really come up with a really decent plan. Looked at many different buildings that were so-so that we could potentially rent, and none of them just really shook me that much. I just wasn't that impressed with any options that we had. And then what ended up happening was the city offered us a lot, and they would give it to us because they were trying to attract business, so they were going to give us a lot downtown to build on. And they called me one day, and they were just like, you know, We have a person who wants this lot. We have to have an answer from you. And I don't remember if they gave me a week or what it was, but he said, we need to know if you're going to take it or not, because if you aren't, somebody, we have a signed letter from another company who is going to take it if you're not. And so I called them back a few days later, whatever it was, and I told them, we don't have any letter from the bank. We have no guarantee that we will be able to get a loan. We have no way to take the lot right now because we can't promise to build a building right now. We're just not that. We're not that far yet. We're not ready. So I said, you better let the other person have it. So they did. So then we were just back to where we were at the beginning, trying to decide where and how we would expand our store. Well, in the meanwhile, it happened that we met this guy, his wife, he's dying of cancer. They've got 7 kids or whatever it was, and we find them at the store. We find out that they don't have a proper place to live and so on, and we move them into our house, and they live with us for a few months. And you guys all know the story of this and how this happened. But it was at that time, while they were with us or right about, or just after they moved out or something, right in that time frame, that this is like a year later from the time that we told the city of Merrill, we just got to let this lot go, we can't do this, that I talked to them again, the city of Merrill, and they tell me the lot is available again. The person who took this lot backed out and are not going to build right now. But by this time, we were far enough along with the bank that we said, okay, we'll take it. Well, I can't convince you of this truth, but I am absolutely certain in my own head, I am absolutely certain that God opening the door for us to build that store in Merrill was a direct result of what we did for John and his family. I am absolutely certain of it. The coincidences were too great in how everything went together and worked that way. So anyway, Merrill ends up giving us that lot, a downtown city lot, which appraises at $455,000 after the appraiser, which it's really not worth that, but you know how appraisals work, you know. It's not worth that much money, but that's what the appraiser puts on it as its value. And so the value the appraiser puts on this lot goes to the bank for our down payment to build the store in Merrill. And basically we get this store for free, more or less. I mean, it's not free. We have 25 years to pay for it. But I mean, we didn't have to invest into it so much as it was. The lot is given to us, and the bank is going to take the lot as the down payment and give the rest of the money. And everything just went. You know, you don't think that happened in the life of Job when God saw him taking care of the poor and needy? Why do you think Job got rich? Now, some of us, like me, with different opinions, I sat and struggled and struggled and struggled in business for many, many, many years, thinking that it was on me to build the business. It's not on me to build the business. What God demands of me is that I do what He tells me to do. He doesn't give a hoot about my business. Take my business away and send me to hell if I don't listen to Him. My business is nothing to God. Either I use it for the things He gave it to me for and I serve Him with it, or He doesn't give a hoot if I have it. But He absolutely requires me that I am righteous in my dealings with people. Now, don't come after me and tell me I'm not there yet, okay? I'm still working probably on it. But I remember this very specifically when this understanding hit me many, many years ago, that the way everybody was helping me out and had sort of come to the point where it seemed to me like it was just the right way for things to be because I had the big project going. And I finally came to the realization, the actual truth is, why shouldn't everybody have a big project going? Why should I be the one to have the big project and they be my helpers? They need to live just like I need to live. They're going to need to get married, have a house, have kids, take care of themselves, get a business if they want. Why should I get anything? And it totally changed my life when I realized that if I have my neighbors working for me, then I owe them. It got to the point where I quit asking people to help me out for anything without offering to pay them. And I don't like that. I think people have gotten used to the fact that I pay. I don't pay for anything anymore. You guys can help me for free if you want to. No, but the fact of the matter is, I was convicted that the way that I was, not necessarily anything I was doing was wrong, but my mindset was wrong. My mindset was wrong in that I thought I was owed something. I thought that it was right for people to give to me or to do things for me as though I needed, because I needed them. I didn't need anything besides obedience to God. That's what I needed. And I needed to make sure that if somebody was taking care of me, I was also taking care of them. I could honestly care less about my business right now. I wish I had 100 stores, but I'll tell you, if God wants it, he can have it. I don't really care about it. If the only reason I want my business at this point is because I think that it is God's will that I work, and there's things that I can do with it. But I don't have the same feelings about it that I used to have, where I used to want it because I wanted it. I don't want it anymore because I want it. I just want it now because it's useful. And God can have it if he wants it. All the way through this chapter, this is what God is talking to these kings about. They didn't do basic things of righteousness. Basic situations of righteousness between man and man. They failed to uphold. And they were covetous. And they looked at their own things, their own wants, their own plans, their own intents. And they looked at those things they wanted to build their own life instead of looking at the needs of humanity around them. That's what God takes them to task for in this chapter, and they are judged for it. And Jerusalem is carried away captive, and Coniah is promised that he will never have another man coming after him of his seed that will sit on the throne of Israel. God finishes the kingdom. He takes away the kings. He breaks down the city of Jerusalem. He destroys his own temple. He sends his armies to do these very things, to destroy the city of Jerusalem and take the people away for 70 years to another country because they didn't take care of the people that he had put in their path. That was what he was mad about. It wasn't the only thing. I mean, he speaks in many times. We've been reading it in the books of the kings when he talks about all the worship of idols they did, and so on. You know, there was multiple sins connected with these people. But in this chapter of Jeremiah, this is the thing that he brings out to the kings, that they were unrighteous to their fellow man. Now, my time has passed. We're going to take a break. We have one more chapter to go in this book. Let's dismiss.